Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Wood burning is often touted as a clean alternative to fossil fuel consumption, and that is true. But we haven't looked at all of the costs of using this resource. So says Andy Friedland, a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth College. He says we need to take all of the consequences into account. In a study that his team conducted, they looked not at the effects on the air of burning wood and not at the effects on forests or creatures of cutting wood. What they're looking at is deeper, the effect of logging on the soil and the carbon that is stored there. Professor Friedland joins me now. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much.
Why do we need to look at the carbon stored in the soil if we're trying to figure out what the consequences of burning wood are?
Well, I think a lot of people are trying to do things to ameliorate the effects that you were just talking about in your last segment, that is, reduce the amount of CO2 that humans are pumping into the air. And it's common to think about the above-ground carbon, the carbon in wood, and we know that if we cut down a forest, we burn that wood and it releases carbon to the air. But for a long time, the general public maybe doesn't even think about the mineral soil below the organic horizon, and even many forest scientists haven't looked at the deeper soil horizons. They, in fact, have a great deal of carbon, and it's becoming apparent, we think it's true, that when you disturb a forest at the ground level by, say, cutting down trees, you're actually altering the carbon deep in the mineral soil.
How much is the soil disturbed by logging activity?
Well, there are obvious cases where there's been, say, some unfortunate logging that leaves large ruts. But what we're looking at is lightly disturbed surface horizons that we don't know what is happening, but perhaps mineral acids or organic acids or nutrients from the surface are leaching deeper into the soil and perhaps stimulating microbes or causing other activity that causes that carbon to be mobilized and released into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So we really don't know the answer to your question, but those are some of our hypotheses.
Do you then also know or not know how much carbon is actually being released, how much carbon dioxide?
No, so that's not known either. But we are, in the paper you mentioned, it's a team of investigators that's from Dartmouth and also a group from UVM, including Bill Keaton from the Carbon Dynamics Lab and Thomas Buchholz, a postdoc there. But we are starting to ask this question, you know, is this phenomenon real? In order to say that, we need to see it in a large number of forests, not just one location. And then starting to understand, well, just how much carbon is being released from the mineral soil.
Well, so how are you doing that? I mean, you are looking at more than one location. I understand you've got soil samples from areas around the world, and you're looking as far back as 100 years. I mean, at places that were logged 100 years ago.
So we are, and we're making use of areas where people have historical records, and they know that there was, say, a clear cut done 25 years ago, and nearby a clear cut done 50 years ago. And we're making use of these different time sequences to say that, oh, we can now quantify how much carbon was lost in the 25 years since logging or in the 50 years since logging. Or after 100 years after logging, all the carbon that was there has returned, has been restored to the mineral soil.
You mean because you'll take samples from a similar location, but one that has logging that happened 100 years ago versus one 25 years ago versus one that has not had any logging activity?
Exactly. And we are making an assumption, which some people want to quibble with our assumption, that these were all uniform in their carbon amounts, say, 150 years ago. And so it's an imperfect experiment. The perfect experiment would be to start right now and measure the carbon in the mineral soil in a large area of forest, and then every 5 years cut some of them, and then wait 100 years and or wait 50 years and measure everything. But most scientists and most people don't have 50 years to run an experiment. So we're making use of historical logging activity to learn about carbon today.
And what are you finding so far?
So one of my studies has found that maybe it's not surprising that if you cause more disturbance as opposed to less disturbance, there's more carbon mobilized from the mineral soil. So that is harmful logging activity with a lot of ruts and things like that will release more carbon from the mineral soil into the atmosphere. So that's one of our early findings. And now we have some papers that are currently under review. So so those papers, I probably shouldn't talk about them because they haven't yet been peer-reviewed by other scientists, but we're starting to see some of these same suggestions. The other thing we've done, as you mentioned, is we found studies all around the world, only 5 or 6 of them, but they are out there, that maybe didn't bring attention to this fact. They were publishing about forests and publishing about soils for other reasons, but when we look at their data sets, we observe this phenomena that 20, 30, 50 years after logging, there seems to have been a reduction in mineral soil carbon. So we think we're seeing the pattern elsewhere, sometimes with those investigators not necessarily noticing that or bringing attention to it, but we think it's there.
So, Professor Friedland, what early conclusions do you draw then about the sustainability and, you know, greenness of using wood as a fuel source?
So I'm glad you asked that question, because someone could listen and say, see, now there's something else I shouldn't be doing. And I think that without a doubt, burning wood is a green choice, particularly if you're burning it in, say, your wood stove in your home. And it's preferable to burning a fossil fuel like oil, because it's a modern fuel. It's a biofuel that took carbon out of the air only 100 years ago or 75 years ago. But it also helps reinforce that all energy choices are harmful. So there's really no magic bullet. There's no simple way we're going to heat our homes without causing some kind of environmental harm. We already know about wood, that it is certainly, as it was mentioned earlier in the show, it's local, and it's something that, you know, you can get from nearby, so it's good for the local economy. There's ideas like that it fragments habitat. You mentioned creatures, that mm-hmm. it hurts organisms in the environment. So we know what some of the good things are, some of the bad things are, and this is adding one more piece of knowledge to the puzzle as to what are going to be the least harmful energy choices we make to heat our homes or perhaps to do other things, heat buildings, generate electricity.
But I guess one of the points here is that people may not have even thought to question how much carbon dioxide was being released into the atmosphere from the soil in logging activities that maybe aren't even so disruptive to the soil. So you're saying we need to look at all of the potential consequences.
Yes, that's right.
Andy Friedland is a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth College. He and his team have just published a study of how forest practices affect carbon release, and we've been talking about what that means for using wood as a fuel source. Professor Friedland, thanks very much for sharing your findings with us, and I hope you'll send us those studies when they're peer-reviewed and ready for us to look at.
Thank you.